So, Gordon, thank you so much for being with us today. We're super excited to jump into it. So let's start with your backstory.
Okay. Well, I was that rotten, snot-nosed little boss's kid that everybody complains about. My dad started in the car business in 1940. And so as a family, we're running now on in May, it'll be an 84-year tradition. But he had been a Hudson dealer and had a used car lot. Eventually, after running a Ford dealership for Ford Motor Company, wound up being a Chevrolet dealer, and then he sold out of that, and he and I became partners in a Chrysler store. I started in the business in 1973, mostly to spend more time with my dad, because he was, you know, back in that day, the grind was what everybody did. It was a 70-hour work week. And so I started. He couldn't get me a work permit. He paid me 50 cents an hour out of his pocket, and that's where I began. Just, you know, washing cars and doing the janitorial, and it was a helper in the body shop, and just I learned every task throughout the store. The thing that I'm always thankful for about that is that the guys that I was working next to were shop guys that figured, you know, what they were getting at that time, probably $7-$8 an hour, and they figured I was getting 20 and treated me that way. And on the other side, my dad was expecting high performance out of me. And so it created a work ethic that has driven me to this day. Gotcha. So that's kind of how it all started. We were in the Chrysler store for 20 years, had tremendous success. Had the unfortunate luck of having a massive internal theft with seven figures. So we wound up selling that franchise off, and what the guy didn't want out of it was my little itty-bitty buy-here, pay-here story. It wasn't going to deal with them people anymore. Heck with it, you know. And so I came up here. We've been here 22 years now, exclusively buy-here, pay-here, and love it. Customers are wonderful. We actually make a better return on our investment than we ever did with a Chrysler store. So it's a nice, efficient, small operation.
Well, buy here, pay here is interesting because I think a lot of people jump into it. They think it's easy, but if you don't understand it, oof, it can burn you.
It's the fastest way there is to go bankrupt.
Yeah.
The joke in the industry is if you want to become a millionaire and buy here, pay here, start out with $2
million.
I know. I've never had that experience. We started, actually, I found out about buy here, pay here in a 20-group meeting when we still had the Chrysler store back in 1992. And we just kind of delved into it, and very quickly it took over my used car lot. So we had to separate it. And so we had the conventional used car lot with the store, with the new car store, and then we had a separate location for buy here, pay here. And it has been marvelously profitable. It supported us when we went through that period with the theft and everything else. Kept us alive until we were able to remarket the Chrysler store and so forth. It's been a real blessing.
Well, tell us the meaning behind the name of your store today. I love the name.
The Good People Automotive.
Good People, yeah.
So it's Termolyn's Good People Automotive is our DBA. The Good People moniker actually was something that we started doing marketing on back in the Chrysler store in I think about 1987, and we had all the sales guys had little pin on buttons that said Good People. Most of them had them boxed sideways, and we just made that our logo, and stayed with it and built branding themes upon the Good People concept. So we employed good people. We created standards and job descriptions predicated around the kind of person that you'd want to do business with. Kind of looked like a Boy Scout creed, but it, you know, I've got little cards we still hand out to our employees. You know, you're going to be honest. You're going to be proactive. We're going to do this, this, and this. And if they get along with that and they internalize it, they're long-term employees. If they don't, well, they've been here for a job. And as I've always found that to be the case. On the flip side of that, we are doing business with good people, period. Doesn't matter if they make $500,000 a year or $25,000 a year. Everybody sees themselves as a good person, and you need to treat them accordingly. And we find that when we have that kind of attitude toward our customers, we're far more successful.
Love that. Love that. What would you say your number one asset as a business owner is?
Without question, my people.
Human capital.
I mean, you know, when we were at the Chrysler store, you know, turnover in a new car store is every 6 months. Sales guys were in and out. My rookie was 4 years in.
Wow.
You know, our people don't leave us. We do things that create kind of a cause type atmosphere. So you're not just here for a job. You're just not here to make money. That's certainly part of it. But we're going to train you and support you. You have to give us your time and your skill set, and we will all win together. And when you have that kind of a mentality, everybody joins in, and it's just, it works marvelously. So we're blessed.
And there's a belief that if you take care of your people, they'll take care of your customers.
They honestly do. You know, when I was at the Chrysler store, I could walk out any given day and be gone for a week and nobody'd even notice. And I think the same is true here. You know, I'm to the point now where I leave for NIADA activities and trips and speeches and things of that nature. Nobody misses me. You know, my son does bookkeeping and so forth and is quite adept at it. He steps in. He's also, of course, he's learned the ropes of the car business the same way I did. Started out washing cars and built his way up. So if he needs to step in and sell a car, he just does. And so it works really, really well. Same in our shop. You know, I've got, you know, we've only got three technicians, but, you know, two of them have been with us well in excess of 5 years. The other one's been with us for, I think, three now. And they just, you know, they stay and take care of business for us.
So as the president of the Independent Auto Dealers Association, have y'all done anything centered around customer experience? Because certainly you know it firsthand. And customer experience is everything today. You know, if you don't take care of the customer, somebody else will, and that's normally your competition.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a market factor. You know, the first thing, you know, the first item in our mission statement here at our dealership is to serve the transportation needs of our customers, which seems a little broad, but you know, if they came to us, we need to honor that. You know, the next thing is we're better in competition because we operate in a global marketplace. So you've got people that are going to take your customer if you don't take care of them. The last thing is to make a profit. That sounds on the surface like, you know, we're business guys and we want to make money, blah, 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 and we do. I mean, if I invested my money in the stock market, I'd expect a return. But everybody needs to get a return out of that. So my employees give their very best. They are skilled people. They care for our customers. They receive a commensurate pay package. Our customers came in wanting something, and they darn well better leave with what they wanted. I mean, that's how they profit. So if you do it well, everyone wins all the way through. That's just our mentality toward it.
That's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. So when finding these good employees, because I know nowadays I speak with a lot of dealerships, and a lot of things that they harp on is, you know, there's not a lot of good talent out there to hire. So when you're specifically looking for talent to hire, what are you looking for that makes that salesperson a good person in order to work for you?
It really starts with attitude here. I mean, more than anything else, you know, and if I'm looking for somebody in the shop, you know, I'll start a young person who's kind of a minimum wage type individual and so forth. And when they're slow, I look to see if they're bothering the service advisor for something else to do, or do they grab a broom and pick up, or do they just sit in the corner and grab their phone? Huge difference. Because if they're interested in that phone more than their career, there's only so much I can do to inspire that or help them through it. So we're looking for people that just have that attitude that, you know, the way I get better is I give value to my employer, and my employer will see that and give value back to me. And so it's not a common mindset. It's gotten far more difficult than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But there's still people out there. You know, it's funny where you find it sometimes. Two of my technicians are former customers, and they knew about us. They knew about our attitude, how we did things. I was impressed with the way they handled their personal business, even under difficult circumstances. And so when we had the opportunity to hire them, we did, and they've done marvelously well. So
that's amazing. You mentioned the phones. It's pretty incredible to me when I go into a business, some big company names, and employees are looking at their phone instead of serving the customers. And it's a problem. I mean, it's a distraction.
I think one of the highest gain opportunities for young people today are, and this can really sound critical, I don't intend it to, but to develop a personality that is engaging, that can draw people out and make a connection, is far more important. You know, nobody is teaching them in school how to do commerce, how to brand and how to build and how to make things for your life to improve your own lot in life. So, you know, what they do want to teach them constantly, because it's easy, is tech. So even when they're doing online classes and so forth, you know, when we had COVID and all the rest of it, they're plugged in and they're, you know, pushing on the screen and the keyboard, and they're disconnected from individuals. We see a number of people, our customers also, that just don't know how to make the connection. You know, we've had to stop credit applications midstream and just put the pen down until they realize that they have to look up and pay attention to us.
Right.
And it's a difficulty that I think we're going to, until we become wise enough to realize that this is just a tool. Right. It's not your life, and put it back down and forget it. And it's going to be a while.
It's amazing how, I don't know, just entranced we are with our phones and how much it's become a part of our lives. I mean, I was talking to Chris about this the other day. It's, you know, I left my phone somewhere, and I swear I could feel it in my pocket vibrating. It was that phantom vibration. And, you know, that's when I was like, all right, I'm going to, you know, pretty much every night after 8 o'clock, I put my phone on do not disturb. I don't look at it. I don't talk to it. Instead of turning on the TV, I find a good book to read, you know, just to kind of reset your brain. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people are kind of missing out on that nowadays, and they're just so tuned into technology that they're not focused on just those old-fashioned values anymore.
If you study the psychology of addiction, you know, Apple and all these other folks have done a marvelous job of addicting us to these things. What am I going to miss out on if I don't have it with me?
That's right.
You know what? I mean, maybe I'm just, because I'm a fossil, it's a different thing, but I I understand that you'll be okay without it.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I grew up in a day when I was at college, and I'd call my folks once a week, and half the conversation was with my dad to find out what the buy list was, because I paid my way through school auctioning, you know, buying cars at Flint Auto Auction in Michigan. And so we'd talk about that, and then I talked to my mom for a little bit, hang up, and what they didn't know didn't upset them. And I'd live just fine that way. You don't. The constant contact can ruin you too.
It really can. And you know, there's it's a distraction. Social media was designed to bring us together, and it's really driven us apart. And that's pretty telling. When you walk into a restaurant and you look around, and entire tables are on their phone, and they're not conversing. But that's the negative side. The positive side of social media is that you can, it's very cost effective to brand yourself today. There's a unique opportunity among business owners to really get closer to their customers, because you can engage with them for the first time ever. Mm-hmm. You can.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's we've always had push marketing until the digital age. And push marketing was, we just push our message out there and hopefully it finds the right, you know, the people, but now we can actually engage, and that's the exciting part about it, is that it can be super cost effective.
Well, I'm glad you brought that aspect up, Chris, because yes, it's, you know, there's negatives to them, but also the technology is a tremendous tool for good as well.
Right.
A lot of opportunities for engaging and direct engagement and targeting people that otherwise wouldn't know you even existed.
And personalizing your brand. We you know, the hot thing right now is user-generated content. So we encourage our clients, you don't even have to hire a professional videographer today. Pull your phone out, do the customer testimonials, do the virtual, the walk-arounds, the car. Get out on the lot and just show off your inventory. That's what's trending. That's what people, like, if you go on social media, that's all you see today. And that's more effective than hiring that professional videographer that will charge you thousands of dollars to come out to your lot. You can accomplish the same thing with an iPhone.
Yeah, you really can. I actually, there's a very successful dealer down in the Atlanta area. Jack Carter owns a place called Turn and Burn Motors.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the internet on a regular basis and just being a ham about everything he does.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, here's your prepper starter kit, you know, and he's pulling a gun out of the glove box of the thing, you know, and make a joke out of the thing because somebody traded in a vehicle that had a military star on the door and everything else, you know, but having fun with people all the way along it, you know, I mean, and he's very successful because of that.
Yeah, we met him at GIADA's annual conference over at Stone Mountain. Great guy.
Jack's good.
Such a hit. Yeah, definitely.
Yep. So let's shift the conversation to NIADA. What's going on with the organization? And you've been a president for since July of last year?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, so I've been on the board. This is my 12th year. So I worked up. I was a regional vice president, spent some time as secretary as well as treasurer, and then kind of moved into the chairs as the executive vice president, president-elect, and so forth. NIADA has gone through some changes in leadership. Just in my time there, Mike Lynn was in the process of retiring. Steve Jordan came on. You know, Steve was a very sales-oriented, very magnanimous personality kind of guy. When he decided that he was going to move on to greener pastures, we hired Bob Voltman, who really wasn't the right person that they're at that time. Bob was very detail oriented and so forth, and wanted to work on bylaws and things of that nature. And was at a time when vendors and dealers needed more. So Bob then decided to retire. I think he kind of saw that it wasn't the best fit ever. And we now have Jeff Martin as our CEO. Jeff was a longtime executive director for the state of Texas. And so he's well acquainted with the association from running the state down there and is doing a marvelous job. So we're doing some rebuilding on the things that had kind of fallen off the priority map. Our certified pre-owned program, certified master dealer, working on our 20 groups. These are all training programs, and that's one leg of the stool that are offerings for dealers in terms of training and education and things of that nature. At the same time, we're working on, you know, there's a constant government pressure in terms of regulation and so forth. So our national policy conference takes place in Washington every fall. We spent some time on that. We're working with Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to make sure that, you know, reasonable dealers don't dislike regulation, but it's got to make sense and it can't completely crush their business. And so we're trying to make sure that they understand what we're doing there. And we're involved in a number of things, particularly with regard immediately right now to the CARS rule that the FTC is pushing forward, trying to get that to the point where they pull back and really listen to the feedback from the industry before they jump in and make a mess out of things.
Yeah.
So that's our hope. So beyond that, we have a tremendous number of vendor partners and so forth that either offer goods and services at a discount to our dealers, and we want to make sure that those offerings are available so that our dealers can be cutting edge.
Nice. And your annual conference, when's your next one?
It's June 17th to the 20th. I'll be at the Wynn in Las Vegas.
Very nice.
So I got a great rate, $199 a night, including resort fees.
We'll be there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it'll be a great event. So
we're going next week to the NADA, so we'll be out there.
I will probably see you there, too. We're also going to NADA. Amongst the things that we do, we're having an industry meeting with NADA leadership to talk about the CARS rule and some of the things that they're doing there and our relationship in general. We'll also be benchmarking speakers and topics covered, as well as looking for additional vendors and folks that might be of advantage to our dealers. So we're gonna be shopping, so to speak.
Very nice. It's always a fun event. I wanted to pose this question because as EVs start to trickle down to the used car market, what do you foresee there? Relatively new and you know, to replace batteries, like what's your position on EVs?
I just don't think we're there yet, guys. I really don't. I have an economist friend up in Michigan, Dr. Timothy Nash. He works at Northwood University. And early on when EVs were becoming a big thing, I'd been up there a number of times at their annual auto show. The students put on their own auto show every year, and they'd get keynote speakers to talk about electrification and so forth. And you know, they see the market being 10%, you know, and everything else, and it never even got to 1%. Well, now there's a push. There's government money. They're putting $7,500 on the hood of each car. That's not even including the amount of R&D money that they're giving the manufacturers and so forth. And for a while, they were a hot trend. Well, now we're finding out that they're not the best in snow. And, you know, when cold weather hits, we got an issue. The thing that Dr. Nash pulled up and showed me that I thought was very interesting was that at that point in time, and this is probably 2.5-3 years ago, if you took the world's known supply of copper, all of it, times 7, you could get to 50% of market with EVs. So it's almost an unachievable goal.
Right.
Wow. You know, so if you take that in consideration and you see the other minuses with regard to weather, range anxiety, all the rest of it, they're working on that. They truly are. But it's understandable why consumers are not adopting.
Well, last
week. They've been out for 3 to 5 years. You know, they've been longer than that, been out for 10 years in some cases. And they're just, you know, they're not that hot a commodity anymore. And the inventories are starting to grow. So from the independent side, I'm very wary of it. We've had a few. I've had some good luck with hybrids where if a battery starts to go bad, we can replace cells and so forth. And my guys are trained well enough to do that. But a full EV, you know, now I've got to take it back to the factory store and we're looking at thousands of dollars to replace batteries. At that point, the vehicle becomes disposable.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I hate to be a skeptic, but I don't think we're there yet.
I honestly don't think it's being a skeptic at this point anymore. It's just, it's, you know, you see these different things coming out with, you know, just like Chris was saying, with Tesla's having problem in the snow and cars not opening and cars not starting. You know, I don't think that we were, just like you said, ready for EVs yet. And I don't know if EVs are going to be the future. I honestly think that hydrogen is probably the way that everybody's going to lean towards. Because we've just been finally, I was reading an article that we're able to, as safely as we can, make energy out of it without, you know, if someone crashes, it doesn't just blow up on us.
That'd be bad. That'd leave a pretty big crater. but I think over time, I think you're right. I think, you know, hydrogen probably makes more sense. But let's not forget that, you know, we've got literally hundreds of years supply of natural gas and oil in our own possession on our own land that can be sold to other countries to pay off government deficits and all the rest of it. And we're pretty efficient with that. I mean, if you look at what our air quality was 50 years ago, we're better now by far than we ever were. And so I think that case is still out there. And then the readily available supply of fuel, when you go to a gas station, take 3 minutes to gas up, that's a pretty good deal.
And that is interesting that, you know, most of the public transportations use the natural gas, but they haven't moved into the consumer sector.
Well, I think from a consumer standpoint, because it seems like it's a little bit more difficult to deliver. You know, you've got to have the fittings and so forth to put it in there. That's not something that your Aunt Martha can pull up and do at a self-service.
Right.
So I think that's something that they'll need to work out if that turns out to be the market trend. I mean, there's certainly opportunity for it, and it burns cleaner.
Yep.
So there's a lot to be determined yet, and I think to Aaron's point, the market will decide. I mean, everything has to do with the marketplace. I mean, politics. You know, you pick one politician you like, and they might be a doofus 2 years from now, but today they're the hot commodity. Okay. The same is true with EVs. They were a hot commodity, now they're cooling.
Yep.
And so the marketplace eventually figures out where they want to be on anything.
Well, I think the one thing that people who are investing and trying to create these new technologies for us to be advanced on that we need to take into consideration is exactly what Elon Musk did. He made it a pretty much an open source code to these schematics and allowed everybody to have access to the market, which is why EV has gotten to the point that it is at now, why Ford is producing more EVs than they are, you know, gas vehicles at the moment. So I feel like if we can do that with another environmentally friendly technology, I think that'll be the way to go, you know, when it comes to all this. So that way one group isn't just kind of capitalizing on the entire thing. And, you know, and to me, that's just not good for the consumer. You know, the consumer needs to be able to have, you know, to be able to pick all these different companies out, you know, to be able to choose and, you know, have that ability within the free market.
Choice is a really good thing. I mean, that's why they call it a free market, and is, you know, you can do your research and so forth, and you have to have it available first. Yeah, Musk is he's an interesting character, but he's a darn sharp guy.
Absolutely.
So how is the, let's talk marketing AI. Any plans on using marketing AI in the independent world?
You know, there are a lot of guys looking at it right now, and some have had some successes. Others are very disappointed with it. I think it's a little young yet. I think it's going to have to settle in first to see if this determines to be a good thing or a bad thing. I don't see how it could be bad per se, unless it's just plain misused to misrepresent people and so forth. But beyond that, I think it'll be a good tool, but it's young.
We were talking to a dealer the other day that uses it to write his automotive descriptions, his car descriptions. Mm-hmm. Have you used ChatGPT or any of those?
I have not at this point in time. We're tiny enough. I don't have a tremendous need for it, but I'm keeping an eye on it. It's intriguing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. So what else is happening on the independent association front?
I think the biggest thing, you know, it's funny, it had the little check sheet here of things that we might talk about, and one of the things I put down was EVs and regulation. So I think, you know, that sadly we live in a time where, particularly this government, more than others that we've had in the recent past, is really trying to manipulate the market to what they think it ought to be. And so they do that by regulation. And we've had some interesting conversations. I think NIEDA as a whole has a pretty decent relationship with CFPB, surprisingly enough. But then I printed out a synopsis from one of our legal minds that had 10 things from the CFPB, and it made my blood pressure rise again. But it's things they're looking at. You know, they want to look at auto finance and how it's being handled and fees and all the rest of it. I think their goals are noble, but they don't understand. This Federal Trade Commission with the CARS rule, it really could be a mess. And the thing that struck me the most when we had our national policy conference, which I would openly invite anybody, particularly independent dealers, to please come to, because it's a really great opportunity for your voice to be heard. Sat down in the, you know, it's a 3-day series of meetings. First, internally, what's going on with the industry? How's the association doing? How are the vendors doing, and so forth. The next day is alphabet soup. So we've got the Federal Trade Commission, CFPB, EEOC. There, you know, there's always a number of regulators that come in. And the young lady from the Federal Trade Commission was touting the wonderful things they're trying to do. And one of the dealers asked her, because they were talking about advertising and transparency. Nobody disagrees with that, but you know, he asked her a simple question. He said, well, if I advertise a car for, let's say, $79.95, and I would sell that car to anyone for that price, so we're good there. But now a customer comes in who doesn't have acceptable credit with the bank, and so the payment that I quoted isn't going to work. Instead, I have to pay a secondary finance company $1,200 to get that deal bought. Am I supposed to put that in the price? Because then I'd be violating your advertising rule. Or do I have to put it down here where it's going to be scrutinized as a junk fee? And she rambled on for half an hour and never did answer the question. So it illustrates how important it is for them to understand what the heck we're doing and how dynamic the marketplace is. And it's clear that they don't at this point in time. So those are the kinds of things, those relationships are really, really essential. And that's one of the things that NIEDA is really working hard on.
One thing that you would tell consumers? Because, I mean, if you read the CARS rule and you're just a normal, like, everyday consumer like me, and you read the CARS rule, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. What would you tell consumers that to help better explain, to kind of get your point across from the dealership, you know, like, standpoint?
Aaron, the thing that I've told consumers for, gosh, probably the last 35 years of my career, okay, is stop shopping based upon price. You know, you scrutinize the vehicle you want, okay? And everybody wants a good deal. What exactly is a good deal? I mean, I've never met a person yet could honestly define it, you know, because if it's a low payment, you can finance it for 96 months and get a low payment, you know, or is it, you know, is it the interest rate? Well, you know, that can be manipulated up or down. Is it the price on the car? Okay, the price has a hard cost. But if it's trade-in value, that can be manipulated. So shop for a good dealer. Look for someone who has an excellent reputation. You know, ask your salesperson questions enough to determine if this person is actually a career salesperson or somebody that's been there for 6 months and is waiting for an opening at another job someplace and won't be there to follow up and take care of you. Do your due diligence in terms of the service experience at that dealership. Talk to people, look at the Google ratings, and read the bad ones and determine if the person just had a bad attitude or if it's a true bad service experience. You know, if you do all of that ahead of time, and that's really the due diligence of being a proper consumer, you're going to wind up happy. You needn't worry about all the forms and the things you're going to sign, because you're going to get somebody who, in the interest of their own career path, is going to explain well exactly. They're going to present the features and the benefits and ask you to make a decision on the extended warranty or the rust proofing or the topper and then the vehicle itself. They're going to offer you an opportunity to take the vehicle out and have an independent party inspect it. They will transparently show you everything they've done to put the car through the shop. And these are things that I do in a little itty-bitty buy-here-pay-here dealership. Certainly you could do that in a store that's selling 500 units a month just as easily, okay? And when you're getting that kind of experience, you don't have a need for regulation or additional forms. I understand that, you know, what CARS is trying to do with it and everything else. We've had many conversations over the years as a board with Federal Trade Commission and the CFPB about how we wished you could get the goofy fees out, but we specifically were looking at, you know, when a dealer puts an online ad in, say, an AutoTrader or CarGurus or something like that, to get to the top of the page, they'll make their price just ridiculously inexpensive. And then in the mouse print with that ad, you'll see plus $3,995 reconditioning fee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's we are completely dead set against that. And that's something that we don't want to see anybody do. That confuses consumers. It makes us all look bad because unfortunately we all get thrown into the same pot.
Those dealers that give good dealers a bad name.
Exactly. I mean, I've been in this business a long time. I've known literally thousands of dealers. And we all know that 1 or 2% that do that crazy stuff on a consistent basis and make us all look bad. And yet when you survey consumers about their last purchasing experience, they go, oh yeah, well, I bought my car from Charlie and he just, now let me tell you what he did for me. He's, you know, and how many people you referred to him? Well, only three, you know, but that's the experience we want consumers to have, is one that they're so happy about it that, number one, they've received everything they wanted and then some, so they happily hand their money over to you to get that product and that service, and that they feel good enough about it to tell their friends the same thing.
Yeah. You can't pay enough for that. That's the best kind of customer to have. It does the talking for you.
Well, and they're available. You just got to treat them well.
Right.
So that's the difference, I think, between a mindset of somebody that's going to be in the business for 2 or 5 years versus somebody that's going to make this a career.
Or how do you define success?
What? you know, I'm a faith guy. All right. So success is a different animal for me than just, you know, climbing the hill and getting the reward and all that other kind of stuff. I think to be able to live a free and prosperous life where, out of my own self-interest, maybe originally, I bought a couple of cars and I flipped them on the side and I made a little bit of money. And then I started increasing my skills. And pretty soon I hired an employee, and that employee now is realizing his dreams while I realize my dreams. We're working together on it. And oh, by the way, my kids and my wife and everybody are well taken care of, and we're living a good lifestyle. And in the process, we built something that consumers come to because they get what they want too. And it's, you know, when all is said and done, I take my profits or, you know, whatever I've gained by living that lifestyle, and I'm able to contribute to my community, to help others, to do some charitable things, and have a positive effect on everybody that I come in contact with. That's a good life. I'll count myself a success when I get there. I'm working on it. But
I think it was Zig Ziglar who said, if you help enough others get what they want, you'll get what you want.
Get what you want. Exactly. Love Zig.
Yeah. He was great. I actually met him at a breakfast and got my picture taken with him. I was a big fan, so that was special.
I missed an opportunity to spend some time with him. We went down. I had a sales contest, and I took four of my sales people down to St. Louis where he was speaking. And we got there early, had some dinner, still were there early. So we're walking around the place, and we see this guy jogging, you know, and kind of look awful lot like Zig, but dang, he was tall. Well, he didn't look that tall on video, so I never thought to say hi. But sure enough, that was him.
That was him, yep.
He went for a run before he gave his presentation.
I also met Tony Robbins back in the day. I used to drive him around. I was a big fan of his, too, so I was working for a limousine company, so I arranged to handle his limo time when he came to Atlanta, and we did that, I think, 3 times, and so I got to interact with him personally. He's tall.
That's
6'7".
Yeah, yeah. That, wow.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
A lot taller than me, that is for sure.
I'm 6'7 on the inside, but not on the outside.
Same. I wake up 6'8 every day. So you touched on something about community. Chris and I and Bill, we all have this saying that, you know, we've really utilized and we like to preach and kind of put into our work with these dealerships, which is, you know, we want to bring the community back to the dealership and put the dealership back in the community. And the best way to do that is to be able to support your community. And I think you already do that in a couple different facets. One, you know, you're bringing on good people. They may not be the most experienced people, but they're good people who have great work ethic, who want to work, who want to learn, who want to be advanced. So, you know, you're giving that opportunity. What other things do you do within the community that really kind of sets yourself apart from, you know, the average Joe?
Aaron, I would tell you, I don't talk about that a great deal because it's not, you know, it's kind of the kind of thing I want people to just know about and so forth. But, you know, we've been in Freeport for 50 years as a family. And, you know, over the years, we supported the Soapbox Derby group for probably 10 years. The Park District did a Candyland ball where the week before Valentine's Day, fathers could take their daughters out to a ball. Did that on our showroom floor for years. And you get 200 little girls running around your showroom floor. It's just, oh boy, I'll tell you, it's funny. So we've done that stuff. We sponsored art gallery things. We do scholarships for young tech students that are going to the local community college, things of that nature. So we're involved. We support, you know, the local Showtime group, which is a theater group through our high school, things of that nature. But a lot of stuff we don't even talk about. I adhere to the idea of trying to tithe our earnings from the dealership. Some years we go above, sometimes we don't get quite there. But I prefer to do it as personally as humanly possible. I remember years ago, I was 7 years old selling, you know, sparkled calendar candles for our local choir group, and I hated it. You knock on the door, and people are getting all mad and slam the door on it, and never forgot that. And so when somebody is brave enough to come in here and want to sell me Girl Scout cookies or you know, pancake tickets or whatever, I thank them for doing it, and we buy some whether we use them or not. We try and support people on a very personal basis that way.
That's awesome. You know what I do, Gordy? I coach them because when I open the door and they go, do you want to buy some Girl Scout cookies? I'll go, I will if you ask me the right way. And they look at me and I go, you can't ask me if I want to. You have to say, which ones do you want? Do you want, do you like these or these? Ask the, is the alternate choice clothes.
You know, I don't know. I've got a daughter. And she's a marvelous character. She's got a selling personality if ever there was. But when she was, oh, I don't know, 11, 12 years old, she was in Girl Scouts and she got her chance to sell cookies. And I listened to her, you know, because she was calling the relatives and so forth. And I said, you know, Karina, you have to do it differently than that. Just, you know, pick up the phone and use your happiest voice possible and go, hey, I'm selling Girl Scout cookies. How many boxes do you want? And she looked square at me and said, Dad, that will never work. 5 minutes later, I hear her on the phone. Sure enough, she did. And I knew I was in trouble when I had to sign a voucher to the Girl Scouts of America for $2,500 for the cookies she sold. We had those things all over our house, bagging them up ahead of time so she could deliver them. But it's and what a great experience for a young lady to gain the confidence to realize she can do that.
Wow. It's all in the approach. That's incredible. That's awesome.
It really is.
Well, my last question, Gordy, and then we'll wrap, is, like, it's a, you know, esoteric one, but, like, what do you want to be known for?
I would love for people to just know I helped them at some point in time. You know, whether it's somebody who's down on their luck buying a buy-here-pay-here car or an employee or folks that I just randomly come across. I want to bring a little sunshine to their day. You know, that's I think that's the best way to go. I sure don't want them whispering my name in vain, so I gotta treat them well.
That's awesome.
I like that.
Well, Gordy, it's been an honor spending time with you. Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you next weekend in Vegas, and we'll definitely grab a cup of coffee.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate the time. It's been fun.
Thank you so much. Now we'll
all right, Gordy, thank you very much.
Pause right here, and then we'll go into the beginning. Hold on one.
You back.
Just gonna, 1 second. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Sensei Playbook Podcast, Marketing and Sales Strategy for the Dealer World, so you can do less and hopefully make more. We have an exciting episode for you today with Gordon Tormolin, the reigning president of National Independent Automobile Dealers Association, current owner and operator of Good People Automotive. He was brought up in the car business, and his family has won more awards than I can ever mention. He's done it all, franchise, independent, and buy here, pay here. So I'm super excited to jump into this week's episode and learn more about Gordy and his experience in the automotive universe. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did, actually. Oh, good job.
Okay.
I know. Yep. I was impressed.
Awesome.
My parents used to laugh. They had friends they'd had for 30 years. They spell it different every year on a Christmas card.
I have the same issue. My last name is completely made up. So the only time you'll ever see my last name is with someone from my family.